two more police officers have been killed on the job. The latest violence happening just this afternoon on the Bridgewater College campus in Virginia, east of Washington, D.C. The suspect was caught right after the shooting, not far from campus. Take a look at these incredible pictures. And then take a look at this image. This is the person they arrested. His name is Alexander Wyatt Campbell. He's been charged with four felonies, including capital murder. Police are not commenting yet on what relationship he may have had with the school, if any, but they were originally called after employees spotted him and said his behavior was suspicious and that he was in a place where he should not have been. When the two officers approached, he allegedly shot them both dead and ran off. He was arrested in this dramatic scene just across a river that he'd waded through. The victims in this crime were campus police officers. They are identified as J.J. Jefferson and John Painter. An alert was sent to the Bridgewater student community saying that the two officers were close friends and that this is the tragic part. Painter was recently the best man at Jefferson's wedding. After shots were heard, the students and staff were ordered to shelter in place for more than 3 hours before they were released. We're going to continue to watch the development, obviously, in that story. And just as this is happening, on the first day of February, 1 month into 2022, I have a jaw-dropping statistic that's just come out. 32 police officers have now been shot in the line of duty. 32. It's only been a month, guys, in 2022. Seven of those officers shot have been killed. Three of those victims were ambushed. But I can't tell you that it's only three because I still don't know what happened in Virginia and why those two officers were shot. Were they ambushed? Was this just instant violence? We'll find out. But the violence against police has gotten so bad that the president of America's Fraternal Order of Police says it is the worst he has seen in his 36-year career. And I have another case in point. New York is burying a second police officer in just 2 weeks. Here we go again. The images just today. Yet another grand wake at the famed St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue. And yet another sea of white-gloved brothers and sisters in blue will be standing on guard. Today, it's Officer Wilbert Mora. Last week, it was Officer Jason Rivera on the right. Both of these good men were savagely murdered by a career criminal who had posted anti-police messages on social media. He ambushed them with a stolen Glock. If you think this is just a New York or Virginia problem, think again. The number of cops shot across the country in January alone marks a 67% increase from 1 year ago. And if you don't care about the police, maybe you care about the civilians that they are sworn to protect. Because they're being killed at unprecedented rates, too. 12 major U.S. cities broke their annual homicide records in 2021. Philadelphia, Austin, Columbus, and Portland, Oregon. Yeah, those cities, they're among the 12. I bet you weren't expecting that. So at a time when it looks like we need more protection than ever before, good luck finding those officers because they're turning in their badges at historic levels. In a one-year period, there was a 45% increase in the retirement rate. And that's not all. There was nearly a 20% increase in resignations compared to a year prior. Throw in a heavy dose of demands to defund the police all across the country, and it's a recipe for cops in crisis. With me tonight is Chuck Wexler, Executive Director of the Police Executive Research Forum, and Doug Griffith, President of the Houston Police Officers Union. Welcome to both of you. And may I just extend my condolences right off the bat. I didn't expect to begin our interview with two brand new deaths just within the last few hours. So my condolences to you and your brethren about what happened to those Virginia police officers, those campus officers. Chuck, if I could, actually, Doug, let me begin with you because I want to just get an update in Houston. The three Houston police officers who were shot last week, we covered that extensively as well. It was just this insane shootout, a suspect who led them on a high-speed chase, not once but twice, and carjacked someone and shot at all three officers, sent them to the hospital. Do you have an update on how they're all doing?
Yes, ma'am. All are in good shape tonight. The last one was released from the hospital yesterday, and he is in very good condition, recovering at home.
Okay, well, at least that's a ray of hope, but certainly their lives will never be the same. You just don't get shot on the job and, you know, instantly become you again. So, Chuck, why this spike? Why the spike in shooting of officers?
Well, I think it's part of the violence we're seeing across the country. In your intro, you mentioned the number of officers who've been ambushed. At the same time, you have record homicide rates we haven't seen in 20 years. So you've got across the country, you have more guns on the street, significantly more guns. And interestingly, the police have also seized more guns. So you have more guns on the street. Look, I think something has happened since the pandemic, because you trace this back about 2 years. And beginning in March of 2020, saw acceleration of purchasing of guns. And then you had the George Floyd incident, disturbances. So you've had a combination of factors which have contributed to the lethality of violence, and manifested by what we saw with police in New York and in Houston and now today in Virginia. We haven't seen anything like this in years.
I mean, this is just, all of it is depressing. The stats that I listed out, the lead story, you know, about these officers dying today, the wake today in Manhattan, the wake and the funeral last week in Manhattan. It's just, I can't get a breath before I have to process another breaking news story, it seems. So, Doug, what are the complaints that the recruiters specifically are hearing? I understand how the officers feel. I can feel it in my bones. But those who haven't yet been officers, who haven't felt this disdain, who haven't felt this persecution, or who haven't felt, you know, the panic and terror of these ambushes, what are the potential recruits saying when they go to the recruiting office and say, you know what, not for me?
Yes, ma'am. They start looking around and seeing how officers are vilified for doing their job, and they're walking away from that, what we used to think is a great career. They know that if they go out there, they're going to be critiqued for everything they do. So it's very hard for them to come to a job like that when they know they go to the private sector, make just as much money, and not have to be vilified like that.
Makes sense. Okay, so Chuck, I want to go over some statistics with you and get you to just weigh in a little bit here. So there's an online forum called Police One, and they polled 1,000 officers. And they asked, what's the biggest challenge for law enforcement in 2021? And the pie chart is kind of tricky to take in all at once, so let me actually break it down. So amazingly, only 3% said crime spikes. That's on the top right over there. But 37% said recruitment and retainment, what I was just talking about with Doug. 25% said media coverage of policing issues. Then another 21% said officer wellness and morale. 14% were made up of other issues like the defunding, etc. A vaccine mandate was part of that. The use of force legislation and training updates. Those were much smaller on the pie chart. But, you know, 37% with recruitment and retainment, that is a massive number. And I'm just wondering, Chuck, what you think, you know, the obstacle is, and is part of it, is it difficult to recruit African-American officers?
Yeah, well, I think it's difficult to recruit any officers right now. I mean, you have to put this in the context of the whole economy where, you know, getting people to work in different jobs is challenging. And you think about the police and all the police have been through. It is a very challenging environment. If you go into any room full of police officers, and I think Doug would agree with me, and you say to them, how many of you would like to see your daughter or your son become a police officer. Very few will raise their hands. And traditionally, police, you know, recruit from their families, from their friends, and so forth. So it's challenging. And if you think about it, you know, someone watches TV and they watch a video and they see what happens in a car stop, and they see what, you know, the police, how the police are held to a higher standard, which is understandable, but they're human too. And so they look at it and they say, is that the kind of job that I want to be in? And do I want a job where, you know, one day if I make a mistake, you know, I'm going to be held accountable, as you should. But I think the fear is that the standard is becoming unrealistic. And so I think that's the challenge. They have opportunities elsewhere and they're taking them. I think what we have to recognize is we have to incentivize this. And there's still a lot of cops, good cops, that want to do their job. The question is, how are you going to get the future cops in this country? Right now, that's
so incentivizing. Yeah. And when you say incentivize this, that I just sort of find that confounding. So, Doug, weigh in here on the cyclical nature of all of this. Right. So first, there's George Floyd. Well, there's a lot more before George Floyd, but that really got the attention of so many people and so much social media, so many movements around the world. And there was a real push towards defunding the police and the, you know, the anti-police movement. And then you get this surge of death, you know, ambush attacks on officers, you know, 32 shootings of officers, and we've only gotten into, you know, 32 days in this year. Is there a pendulum that will swing? Is there a self-correction? Because I feel like we saw it in the 90s, but we didn't have social media back then, and things didn't move at warp speed back then. So maybe, Doug, just give me that in a nutshell, how social media, communications, media in general, and the pendulum may actually end up playing out.
Yes, ma'am. We've seen this over my career. I've been a law enforcement for 31 years, and we have seen this over and over again. One day you're a hero, the next day you're a villain. And at some point, this will come back around. We know that the vast majority of people in this country support us and what we do, and they understand that police work is ugly. You were just showing a clip a minute ago of our officers being fired upon, and we see that time and time again. In major cities around this nation, you see violent offenders that are released over and over again to go out and offend. And we have to find some way to correct that issue to be able to get law enforcement back in the right direction. It looks bad when you're arresting the same people time and time again, and they're becoming more emboldened and they're challenging us. We have over 110 people in the Houston area that are out on capital murder bonds. And that is just unacceptable, because at some point they're not going to go to court because they're looking at prison, life in prison. And then we have to go out there and deal with them. So it is very dangerous, and we're going to see more of that.
There's a longer conversation to be had for sure. And I'm just going to extend my condolences again to you and your policing community, gentlemen, about what's happened today. Yet again, two more officers. And please wish your Houston officers well for us. You know, I don't even know what to say, Doug. I mean, I can't even believe I'm lumping all these stories into one evening and one goodbye. But Chuck Wexler, thank you. And Doug Griffiths, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We have another top story tonight, and that is facing up to the IRS. It is not always easy, I know it, but very soon it will be mandatory for millions of us. And I don't mean coming clean. I mean handing over your face, literally, in a selfie. The feds say that this is a small price to pay to protect our financial life histories from hackers. But is it, though? Starting this summer, taxpayers who need or want to access IRS.gov are going to have to go through a third party and a security screener to prove that they are who they claim to be. The screener is called ID.me, and more than two dozen states use it already to process jobless benefits. The process is, in a word, taxing, because apart from all the usual steps that anybody with online banking is certainly familiar with, there is a whole raft of documents to upload, from a birth certificate to a health insurance card to an electric bill. And the company is also even asking to verify the user's cell phone account with the carrier. And then there's the step that really has online privacy advocates red in the face: a mandatory live selfie. which has to match the photos or photo in the documents that you just uploaded, because if it doesn't, there is still hope, however. If a three-hour wait for a live video chat with a so-called, quote, trusted referee counts as hope. Before I go on, I want to make clear that none of this is necessary to file your tax return or to pay your taxes owed. It's only needed to use the IRS website, irs.gov, which most of us really never do, but accountants say we really should. That's where we can find our payment histories, for instance, and also the readouts of the income that our employers report paying to us. The IRS says it hears all your complaints, people, and is looking for a less intrusive set of alternatives, but it also says this, and I'm going to read straight from them. The lack of funding for IRS IT modernization has made it impossible for the IRS to invest in state-of-the-art technology. The IRS today uses third-party service providers to validate the identification of individuals who are attempting to improperly gain access to taxpayer accounts. So they include ID.me, which is compliant with the National Institute of Security Technology Standards and used by multiple agencies across the government. That's what the IRS says. And with that, I welcome my guests. Derek Riley is a computer science professor at the Milwaukee School of Engineering, and Evan Greer is deputy director of Fight for the Future, a group devoted to, quote, defending our most basic rights in the digital age. Welcome to both of you. Okay, Derek, I'm going to begin with you. Tell me a little bit about what the threat to the system is really meant to defend against. Like, how bad is it? How vulnerable is all of our special information and our tax info and our data? And why do we really need to protect it with our you know, facial images?
Yeah, so this problem is actually as old as time. So really, all the IRS is trying to do is really protect our sensitive information, our social security number, and those sorts of things are some of our most private information. And so they're trying to find ways to balance the protection of that information with security. And this is always a push and pull. If you want more security, it takes more layers and more challenges to be able to protect the information. So many people have gotten used to unlocking their cell phones with their faces. And so this is sort of an attempt to make it easier for us to make it through these authentication steps that exist. But in reality, we have really sensitive information. So you have to be really careful to ensure that if you are going to get into your IRS account, it actually is you. And so that's really why this is a challenging problem. There's very sensitive information, and they're trying to make it convenient to access.
Okay, so Evan, everything that Derek just said makes perfect sense. And then I also feel like, yeah, every time I go into my banking on my iPhone, it's my face that gets me in there. And I always feel really good about that, right? Like, I feel like nobody else can do that. I also put my face on my driver's license. I put it on my passport. I put it on my work ID. I don't even know what else I put it on. So is this a lot of people freaking out because they haven't really thought through it all?
Unfortunately, no. This is the largest expansion of the U.S. government's use of facial recognition that we know of to date. And it's not just a threat to Americans' privacy and civil liberties. It is a threat to your security, as our other guest was just talking about. We've seen that facial recognition as a verification method is actually easily foiled, sometimes by something as simple as a printed out photo that you hold up to a camera. So this is not actually more secure than more traditional methods like a passcode or providing information about a previous address or a car that you once owned. It's really just a private company that, frankly, has swindled our government into spending money and to giving them data that they then have access to for up to 7.5 years. And in their own privacy policy, they admit that they can share it with other corporations. They have a relationship with Amazon, for example, that they did not disclose, that they were forced to disclose after private employee communications were leaked to the press. So this is a company that we can't trust. And really what we need is a federal investigation into how our federal agencies came to do business with such a shady private company.
So, Derek, I'm going to add one more thing to what Evan just said, and that is that I did not realize this until I did some research on this today, but people of color are actually having a lot more problems with facial recognition technology. It turns out that even the government has data on this that shows the top facial recognition systems misidentify Black people at rates 5 to 10 times higher than that of white people. And when I read that, I think, oh, my God. So that's a lot of people who will be stuck on IRS, you know, .gov, you know, on that 3-hour wait trying to get through saying, yes, it's me, for Pete's sake.
Absolutely. And it's not just racial disparities. There are age disparities, economic disparities. There are, you know, folks who have facial disfigurements who aren't represented appropriately in these populations. The way that these computational models are trained is using large samples of data that cover swaths of the population. And study after study has shown that many of these models use biased samples. So they're basically sampling the data that's available. And if you go out there and look at what's available, you know, you're going to find biases towards folks who are more affluent, folks who have, you know, access to the internet. And those sorts of things are going to ultimately balance and change the way that these algorithms perform. They're going to perform better in certain situations, things they're more familiar with, than other situations. And that inherently disadvantages parts of the population. These algorithms are not well understood or well scrutinized because they typically are owned and operated by private companies. So what ID.me is using is Amazon's recognition technology. And, you know, that's not really open for academic research to scrutinize the real effects that bias can cause with it.
Okay, so Evan, wrap it up for me. If not this system, then yikes, what? Because I actually want something that's going to give me another layer of protection. I thought this would be it.
No, and, you know, absolutely. Look, we all want to safeguard our sensitive financial information, our private information, our social security numbers. The reality is the best way to safeguard that is with actual security. And facial recognition is an unproven technology that is plagued by serious issues of bias. And if we want to keep our information safe, the last thing that we want to do is have the federal government working with a shady private company that's collecting a database of our sensitive biometric information. That's a scan of your face. If your credit card leaks, you can get a new credit card number. If a biometric scan of your face is hacked and stolen, you can't get a new face. Using facial recognition at the IRS makes Americans less safe, not more safe.
So I'm going to just button this up with a quick statement that came to CBS from ID.me. They said, the most damaging thing that can happen to your privacy is not taking a selfie. It's having somebody get access to your medical records or to your tax information. That selfie is actively preventing a massive amount of identity theft. But I can see what both of you are saying as well. It's not the final answer, certainly, here. There's a lot more to it, and I hope to have this conversation in the future with both of you. Thank you, Evan Greer. Thank you, Derek Riley.
Thanks so much.
Right. Still to come, if you are thinking of listing your property on Airbnb, you need to see this next story. The 8 things that you should do right now to make sure that your stuff doesn't get swiped by your guests' sticky fingers. Welcome back to Banfield. It revolutionized the hospitality industry. Airbnb, the company that made hoteliers out of all of us, and discount travelers, too. And what an easy way to make a little extra money on the side, right? Rent out your home while you're away with Airbnb providing the safeguards. What could possibly go wrong? It turns out a lot of things have been going wrong, and you've probably heard about the spy cams and the privacy problems. But now, theft is making its way into the headlines. Some guests have been helping themselves to the personal belongings of homeowners. There's been a noticeable increase recently in online complaints from Airbnb hosts that their stuff has been nicked by their guests. A lot of the complaints are about small and harmless things like a bottle opener here and a 12-pack of toilet paper there, but there's also some bigger things, too, like phone chargers and bedding and even a kitchen faucet. Vintage one, actually. One man even claims some Airbnb renters actually stole his cat. Troy Farrell says the alleged catnappers were renting his neighbor's property when they just went ahead and scooped up his outdoor cat, Nubbins, and then drove off with Nubbins. Farrell says he only found out about it because a vet scanned the cat's chip and called him. But just like with all those stolen toiletries and sheets, Farrell is having a tough time, he says, getting his cat back. So what do you do if one of your guests makes off with your stuff? Can you ever get it back? Can you sue? Will Airbnb come to your rescue? After the break, I'm going to talk to Josh Schiffer. He knows all about this from multiple angles. He's an Airbnb host and he's a lawyer. And wait until you hear what some of his guests have done to him. That's next. Welcome back to Banfield. There are nearly 8 million active Airbnb listings. Wow, it's a lot. That's when homeowners rent a room in their home or the entire home to vacationers. And that can be a good way to make some extra money if you have some extra space, but only if you don't have to repair or replace things that you left in that home. And that's not a guarantee. We've heard about Airbnb guests stealing everything from hand towels to Waterford Crystal Scotch glasses. I want to bring in Joshua Schiffer. He is an Airbnb host and a lawyer and a friend of the show. Josh, I didn't know, first of all, that you had an Airbnb in the U.S. Virgin Islands, and I didn't know that you'd been a victim of Airbnb thieves. What did they take? What'd they do?
Well, thank you so much for having me on. And yes, Meow, we do have one in the Virgin Islands. When we started our practice there, my firm needed a crash pad because it's much cheaper than a hotel. And that's the same for a lot of families and businesses where they want to get a place to stay, save them money, build up a little bit of equity. And the development of Airbnb and VRBO and other companies like that have made that so much easier to manage for people across the world. And it's built this whole new industry where travelers now will go, instead of going to a major flagged hotel, they look for that unique experience that you get with an Airbnb kind of accommodation. But at the same time, there's lots of negative results with some of these stories, and we've been victimized. I think every owner has that owner's closet, and we all expect it to stay safe and secure. But that's not the case, and we have lost toothpaste, toilet paper. We have lost kids' snorkels. We have had people probably go through and use personal items that have already been used, and that's just out of the owner's closet. We haven't started with the person that stole the world's most inexpensive flatware. And then we're trying to figure, did they fly it back to the United States? Did they check a $10, you know, set of flatware? Who takes stuff like this?
Who does that? These people. Okay, so the first thing that I think a lot of people who are watching would think was, well, hold on a second. That's the whole reason we go through Airbnb. They've got to have our backs, right? So do they have our backs? Do they come to our rescue? Do we have legal recourse?
I think the vast majority of people are really satisfied with the way that relationship works. And over the last decade, we've really seen the relationship improve as companies have gotten more efficient in addressing the wants and needs of the landowners, as well as making sure that people renting Airbnbs and other kind of short-term accommodations, they're satisfied as well. Because there's always going to be some conflict. It's how you mitigate that and make the situation livable for everybody involved. And that doesn't include having anything bad happen to Nubbins. I can't believe that someone would try to take a cat or a pet. But again, you're opening up your most intimate space to random people off the street. If you're not expecting something to go wacky or sideways, you got another thing coming. You got to take the right steps. The affirmative steps.
You have to be in the mindset. You do. Okay, so I'm going to tell you the Airbnb, they sent us this statement. I'm going to read it for you. It says the overwhelming majority of Airbnb guests treat their hosts' homes as if they were their own homes. Instances of theft are exceptionally rare, but when they happen, we work hard to support our hosts. Our air cover product is provided for free to hosts on every Airbnb booking, offering top-to-bottom protection. This includes coverage for missing items, including valuables, as well as damage to properties and belongings. So that's a fancy way of saying, hey, we offer free insurance. Is it hard to get the insurance payout, or is it a pretty, you know, boilerplate kind of process, Josh?
Yeah, it's a really standardized process. This isn't some mom and pop shop. They've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of listings and so many different people involved. It has to be something of scale. But then again, it's like any scale insurance product. What kind of loss are you going to expect if you try to take advantage of the benefits of this product? What's the threshold of loss before you're really going to go through the rigmarole of making a claim and having that reflect back on you? Because remember, there's a lot of social credit involved in all of these arrangements, how you're rated by your tenants and how you rate tenants. That's a big issue, especially if you want to be successful.
Okay, so I'm going to wrap it this way, and this is for you, even though I think you know this stuff. I'm going to give you the 8 things to do to keep house guests from robbing you blind. This comes to us from the website Lodgify. Number 1, get a head start and actually do some research on the people coming. Number 2, legal paperwork, draw up an agreement. Number 3, make an inventory, make sure you know what you got and where it is. 4, don't store valuables, don't tempt your guests. Number 5, provide gift items, because if you give them something nice, they may not steal. Number 6, install a home security system, but you cannot spy on them. Number 7, maintain a good relationship with guests, because some people don't like stealing from people they like. And number 8, add a logo to your items. That one I think is crazy. But they're all good advice. And Josh Schiffer, I just love it when you come on the show, so I look forward to your next appearance. Thanks, my friend.
Thank you so much. And everybody, avoid those catastrophic results. Take right choices. Be smart.